There is so much we can learn from history and the ways other people have dealt with translations. In this episode, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Jost Zetsche and talk about some of the strengths of Chinese for translating the Bible, about the richness of its idioms, and more. We're continuing to lay a foundation for some of the history of Bible translation in China. This is the Working for the Word podcast, and I'm Andrew Case. Let's go. Let's get into some of the particular challenges. Each language has challenges for translating Greek or Hebrew. What about Chinese? How does that factor in? Let's start with the challenges from translating Hebrew into Chinese.
I was once asked by my professor, you know, that we're talking like 30 years ago or so. He was, you know, very much not a Christian, but he recognized that the Bible in China is much beloved by you know, Christians. And he asked me why I think that is, that the Bible, which certainly to him didn't feel like a very Chinese piece of writing or collection of writings, would be so much beloved in China. And I answered that because of the wealth of Chinese literature and because of a number of different kinds of writing or categories of literature in Chinese culture and history. A person with some educational background and knowledge of their own culture could see similar styles of writing in the Old Testament. That's not so much an answer about the Hebrew, but about the kind of writing you find in especially the Old Testament. You know, I think often you hear that a specific language or culture loves a certain book particularly much in the Bible because it reminds them on a style of literature that they have in their own tradition, yeah. Right? And sometimes those are really surprising examples, right? I mean, so, you know, sometimes it's the genealogy in Matthew or elsewhere, or it's the, you know, it's the Song of Songs, or it's, you know, it's Ruth often, you know, things like that. Yeah. But I think what you have in the Chinese context is that you don't just have one or two, but you have whole classes of writing that in the Old and the New Testament, but especially I think in the Old Testament, that can be reminiscent of Chinese writing and are similar sort of to the varying styles of Chinese writing.
So one of the challenges I run into a lot with translators going from Hebrew into different languages is a lack of an appropriate idiom to translate a Hebrew idiom. Hebrew is very rich in idiomatic language. Is that ever an issue with Chinese, or do you feel like Chinese is very rich in idioms as well?
It's very rich in idioms. I mean, it's, you know, I think Chinese is a beautifully rich language where you can find many idioms that can be sort of used for Hebrew idioms. There is never an idiom that exactly, I think, describes what exactly the Hebrew or Greek idiom would describe. Often it comes very close. Sure. It's never exactly the same, which is true for any word, of course, too. But I think especially if you feel the freedom to do that as a translator, you feel really blessed with Chinese.
Let's maybe back this up to poetry. So Hebrew, obviously, ton of poetry in the Old Testament. I'm assuming Chinese poetry goes way back. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Way back, uh-huh.
What is it that makes Chinese poetry poetry? I'm interested.
A Chinese poem, I think, especially a classical poem, is never assumed to only have one meaning. It is always assumed to have a number of meanings. And that, of course, is true for most poetry, but I think it's especially assumed in the Chinese context.
Let's switch genres then. So let's go from poetry to Greek letters of Paul. What would be the challenge there with, or maybe there wouldn't be any challenge at all. Maybe walk us through how that would have been difficult or not difficult for the Chinese translators.
I think that aside from the typical difficulties that you have translating Paul's letters being really hard to understand and having sentences right. that never end, et cetera, et cetera, I don't think that Chinese translators encountered particularly much difficulty. Again, they had access to a really large vocabulary. And so what you have to imagine is that China was essentially the primary country where Bible translation happened worldwide in the 19th century. So in the 19th century, there have been, I don't know, close to 40 different Bible translations in China, not of the whole Bible always, but either parts of the Bible or the New Testament or the whole Bible. And mm-hmm. that is, there is no other place in the world where anything even close to that happened.
Right.
And what you of course have when you have such a massively rich and vibrant culture of translation, that you have a very increasingly rich and increasingly settled on vocabulary. And okay. I think that especially with the theological works in the New Testament, like the letters of Paul, that certainly was very helpful. The mm-hmm. more that history of Bible translation progressed. Again, there were differences between some mission organizations and some missionaries, difference of opinion on mm-hmm. what to use in certain cases. But overall, there was a sense, I think, of settled terminology on terms that are otherwise in other cultures might be difficult to translate.
Now, what about sentence length? So the Apostle Paul's famous for his long run-on sentences. In Chinese, what's the preferred sentence length? Long or short or somewhere in the middle?
You know, you certainly don't have the crazy run-on sentences that Paul has. I think that only languages like German and Russian and those kind of languages that, because of the rich morphology, can do sentences like that and still be understandable. In okay. Chinese, you have shorter sentences.
What is the favorite translation of the Psalms?
China is sort of in a King James Version situation. What I mean by that is that there is the Union Version, the Bible translation, where essentially all the different mission societies and mission tribes, Protestant mission tribes, came together and worked together on a translation, on three different translations in three different Chinese styles, of which one, then the Mandarin or the common language translation, became the standard default Bible translation. That's the translation that's still being used today. Now, there has been a revision fairly recently, and much to which was very difficult to communicate to the Chinese church, was much opposition to that, because there was a real sense of this is our Bible, don't touch it, kind of the King James only sort mm-hmm. of attitude, only maybe even stronger.
Okay.
But that revision is now out and is being used. I cannot say how, there is not much, I think there is not much aversion to it necessarily, but also I think no particularly felt need to use it. And I mm-hmm. think that has a number of reasons. And one reason is that memorization is used significantly much more in the Chinese church than in any English-speaking church that I'm aware of.
Fascinating.
And memorization, of course, as yeah. beautiful as it is, doesn't make you want to change the version of the Bible
nope,
you are reading, because that is, of course, the Bible that you have, that you don't yeah. recognize, maybe, even if it's just few changes. And that revised version has just very few changes, you know, but
yep.
still, it's a struggle to make that popular in the many different Chinese churches. So to answer your question, it was of course from the Union Version, from the, you
yeah.
know, that particular Bible translation, which, you know, is slightly archaic now, well, was published in 1919, but is still overall considered to be the standard Bible, whether in its original form or in the revised form, which is not so very different from the original form.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain terms where Chinese excels or is superior to English in being able to effortlessly communicate those concepts?
Hmm. Well, there is certainly one that comes to mind immediately, and that is logos. The translation of logos in English, of course, typically, there are exceptions, but typically is word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was God. And word is not an ideal translation of logos. I think virtually anyone would agree with that. Sometimes I think you might agree that it's the best possible translation because of tradition and because there are aspects of logos and word that are parallel or run similar, but logos is clearly a richer word than word is. And one of the most beautiful, I think, translations of logos, maybe the most beautiful translation of logos, is the Chinese Protestant translation, I should say. Catholics use a different word, with Tao. And Tao is the Tao that you know from Taoism, is the Tao that Confucianists and Buddhists have used, and is really one of the central terms of Chinese thinking and philosophy and religious traditions. Okay. And which is so interesting because that, of course, is logos also to the Greek world, right? Logos is one of the all-encompassing, rich Greek words that, you know, had to do with reason, language, logic, and much more. And Chinese was able to sort of do that by using this word that not only means language and word, but means also the right way. It has a sense of, you know, of course, the logos in John refers to Jesus. It has a sense of divinity. It's one of those fortunate examples where really an untranslatable word, in the sense that it's hard to imagine any culture that has one word that would be able to translate that one word or that one concept. It's still not being translated in a sense that is exactly the same in Chinese, but it's being replaced with an equally rich concept that is deeply ingrained and embedded in the Chinese culture. And by doing that, it not only communicates much of what logos would communicate, but it makes the gospel truly Chinese. It's like branding it as the Chinese gospel. This is what the Tao is about. This is what our culture has been yearning for, essentially. So yeah, that I think is the very, very best example of how fortunate sometimes translations can be.
Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, Taoism is a philosophical tradition which emphasizes living in harmony with the Tao, which is a Chinese word meaning way, path, route, road, original reason or truth, or sometimes more loosely translated as doctrine. In Taoism, the Tao is the source, pattern, and substance of everything that exists. Taoism teaches about the various disciplines for achieving perfection by becoming one with the unplanned rhythms of the universe, called the Way or Tao. Now, the roots of Taoism go back at least to the 4th century BC, so it's really old. Taoism has had a profound influence on Chinese culture in the course of the centuries and still today. Now, C.S. Lewis actually wrote about this in his essay, The Abolition of Man. Here's what he says. The Chinese also speak of a great thing, the greatest thing, called the Tao. It is the reality beyond all predicates, the abyss that was before the Creator himself. It is nature. It is the way, the road. It is the way in which the universe goes on, the way in which things everlastingly emerge, stilly and tranquilly, into space and time. It is also the way which every man should tread in imitation of that cosmic and supercosmic progression, conforming all activities to that great exemplar. End quote. Now, meanwhile, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, around 500 BC, wrote about a similar concept that he labeled as logos. He says, "This logos holds always, but humans always prove unable to understand it, both before hearing it and when they have first heard it. For though all things come to be in accordance with this logos, humans are like the inexperienced when they experience such words and deeds." End quote. Finally, Philo, a Hellenistic Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria in the first century AD extended the concept to a Jewish audience. He said, "For the logos of the living God, being the bond of everything, as has been said before, holds all things together and binds all the parts and prevents them from being loosened or separated." End quote. Now, this is a great instance of how something worked out wonderfully for translation in Chinese, but not everything was easy and breezy like this. This brings us to the controversy over translating baptism. This is not unique to Bible translation in China. It happened in Burma and India and other places in the early centuries of Bible translation. But I want to just say that the difficulty regarding the translation of baptism had nothing to do with the richness or lack thereof of the Chinese language, rather because of controversy within denominations or cross denominations of Protestants. So let's get started with some of this history. As I said in the last podcast, I'm going to be walking us through this book called The Bible in China, The History of the Union Version, or The Culmination of Protestant Missionary Bible Translation in China by Yost Oliver Tsetche. I'm going to be reading to you from large chunks of text in this book. So before we get into the controversy over the translation of the word baptize, I want to start with some of the early history. Now, the history of Bible translation in China possibly dates back to the very beginnings of Christianity in China, which was the introduction of Nestorianism during the Tang Dynasty from 618 to 906. Now, no completely translated biblical book from this period has been found as of the present time. Yet, there is strong evidence in other Nestorian writings and in reports of travelers in China that there was a translation of some books, or even the complete Bible, into Chinese. Now, a quick reminder, Nestorianism was an early heresy that taught the doctrine that there were two separate persons, one human and one divine, in the incarnate Christ. And it's named after Nestorius, who was a patriarch of Constantinople in the 5th century, and this spread throughout the Middle East, and a small Nestorian church still exists today in Iraq. But after that, we have some historical roots of Catholic Bible translation in China that are fairly early. So in 1305, Giovanni da Monte Corvino, who lived from 1247 to 1328, he was sent by the Pope to China and seems to have been working on some kind of translation, either into Mongolian or Chinese. And his manuscript, like many other later ones, is lost. Now, although the very first printed part of a Catholic Bible translation did not appear until 1892 in China, there were lots of other attempts going on before then. So we have the translation of Genesis and parts of Exodus into colloquial Chinese by the Franciscan missionary Antonio Laghi, who died in 1727. Then we have a Jesuit guy named Louis de Poirot, and he worked as a translator at the court in Peking from his earliest adolescence. He translated almost the complete Bible with the exception of most of the prophets and the Song of Songs between 1750 and 1800. Now, the manuscript was stored in the Beitang Library in Peking, where it was destroyed in 1949, unfortunately. But thankfully, a copy had been made for another library before that happened. Now, this guy's translation was in a very colloquial form of Mandarin, which he justified in two long prefaces to the manuscript. So he was basically arguing in his preface that because St. Jerome did what he did in the Vulgate to make it the standard, very readable translation for people who spoke Latin back then, he was trying to do the same thing for China. But of course, when the Vatican heard about the translation in 1803, he was commended for his eagerness, but forbidden to publish his work. Now, finally, there was a guy named Jean Basset, a Catholic missionary. And he lived from 1662 to 1707. And he translated the New Testament, but only in 1945 could it be proven that the manuscript in the British Museum was at least partly identical with Basset's translation. Now, all of this is important because some of the early Protestant missionaries have been shown to be highly dependent on Catholic sources, some of these early Catholic translations, especially the Bassett manuscript. And this deep Protestant indebtedness to Catholic activities in early Bible translation is a fact that has been largely ignored. So who were these early Protestants who began the first translation efforts in China? Well, the main two guys are Morrison and Marshman. And unfortunately, these dominant leaders in early Chinese Bible translation relied relatively little on the help of Chinese translators, on native speakers of the language. And so their translations ended up being kind of hasty productions of men who could hardly have had the linguistic competence to translate the Bible into Chinese. Now, Robert Morrison, let's talk about him. He was a Presbyterian, and he was sent out by the London Missionary Society. So he sailed for China in 1807, and he had an assignment from his mission society to translate the Bible into Chinese. So that was his goal from the beginning. He relied a lot on the manuscript of Bassett, and he otherwise followed the Textus Receptus and the English Authorized Version, as well as other versions. Here's something he wrote. "In the first part of my duty for ascertaining the sense of Scripture, I have used the English Public Version," which is a way of referring to the Authorized Version, "the original Scriptures, Montanus's version, the Vulgate, the French, the Septuagint translation, Thomson's translation of the Septuagint, etc., etc." Now enter a guy named Joshua Marshman. He was an English Baptist, and in 1799, he came to Serampore, a little town on the outskirts of Calcutta under Danish sovereignty, where in 1800, he founded a church with William Carey from the same mission. Eventually, Marshman ended up working with a guy named Lasar to translate the Bible into Chinese. Now, you see where this is going. We have this other guy who's a Presbyterian from the London Missionary Society, and then we have an English Baptist. They're both working on Chinese Bible translations, so there's going to be a clash. On January 9th, 1817, Marshman wrote to his society that the advantage we enjoyed from these translations, referring to Bassett's translations, was that of being able to compare our translation therewith, rather than that of shortening our own labor, which, however, was an advantage we highly prized, and of which we have fully availed ourselves. It is also proper to add that a copy of Brother Morrison's printed edition was presented to us by a friend while we were printing the epistles, and this also we thought it our duty to consult, as often as it appeared desirable. Nor did we think it right to reject any amendment when it appeared to us to be really such. In a work so important as that translating the sacred scriptures, all improvements must be despaired of, and every hope of securing a perfectly correct version of the scriptures given up, if those engaged therein, from a vain and silly idea of appearing original, refuse to consult the labors of each other. It is only requisite that such reference should be cheerfully acknowledged. And I would add that while printing the Hebrews and the following books, I had the satisfaction of consulting Brother Morrison's printed translation, nor did we think it right to sacrifice accuracy to the idea of having the two translations widely different. To those skilled in Chinese, they will be found in this part as widely different, perhaps, as is consistent with a sincere concern in both of us to exhibit the divine word in its purity. But the importance of the relative uniformity relative to scripture names of men and places induced us to adopt the same characters for them, with scarcely any variations. In printing the Gospels some years ago, and the books of the Pentateuch more recently, we could of course avail ourselves of no prior help. So let's talk about the controversy between the two translations about the word baptism or baptize. Now, of course, the Baptists preferred Marshman and Lasar's version, not just because of their denominational ties, but because of their translation of this term. So what did Morrison do to render this term? Well, he used a Chinese word that means to wash, which would be typical for Presbyterians, right? And so then we have the Marshman translation, which used the term in Chinese that means to dip into. Now, of course, I'm sure everyone is aware that Baptist doctrine teaches that baptism can only be performed by immersion. And this is one of the original meanings of the Greek term, baptizo. So Baptists demanded a translation in Chinese, as in other languages, with a term which would imply immersion. Unlike the Chinese word selected by Morrison, which implies immersion only in a very remote way. Now, Marshman used this term in Chinese that means dip into, but later this was replaced by other translators, Baptist translators, with a term that is more specific that means to immerse. And this is a term which today is still in common use in the Baptist Church in China. Now, the conflict over these terms continued to be one of the most crucial questions in the history of Chinese Bible translation. And not until the translation of the Union Version was any attempt begun to find a common Chinese term for baptizo. One option was just to transliterate it like we do in English, right? And this had been done by the Protestant Japanese Bible. And this was only favored by a few people. Another guy named Sharshevsky, who we will talk about at length later, just finishing a biography of him, fascinating guy. He was from the American Episcopal Church Mission. He was a master of the Chinese language, master of Hebrew and Greek. He admitted that this Chinese word that the Presbyterians had selected, that means to wash, would not mean immersion, but neither would it exclude it. Other people weighed in on this and basically said it's too late in the history of the church in China to change the established term from the Catholics and from Morrison, the Presbyterians, successfully. It's already embedded in the language. At the end of the day, none of the missionaries in this discussion argued that this term was the better translation for baptizo. Nevertheless, most of them were not willing to alter the term towards a more correct translation, because it was already tradition. So here you have the Baptist missionaries who wouldn't let go of a literal translation of baptizo so as not to weaken their doctrine. And then on the other hand, you have the non-Baptist missionaries who are only willing to use a Chinese term which would support their own view regardless of the meaning of baptizo. And once again, a transliteration was simply out of the question for both sides. And it's interesting, though, that Sharashevsky pointed out that even though the Japanese Bible contained a transliteration of baptism, Baptist missionaries still used a separate version of the Bible. So basically, it wouldn't have been a helpful compromise in the end anyway. Now, I think a lot of us don't even think about the word for baptize because we are so used to a transliteration in our Western English-speaking culture. Now, I don't have the statistics, but I think it would be really interesting to see how many people are actually involved in Bible translation from a paedo-baptist background today versus the people who are involved from a baptistic background. Now, of course, this has shifted a lot because much of the stuff we're talking about right now in this history was before the advent of Pentecostalism. So many Bible translations, especially the ones going on in Africa, have been deeply influenced by that movement, which started in 1901. And they take for granted baptism defined as immersion. So because of that widespread influence, I would venture to guess that things have significantly shifted away from the paedo-baptist point of view in Bible translation, and that may be a minority now. Of course, on occasion, you do have translations that combine efforts with Catholics and Protestants to create a unified version that both of them can use. I've never worked on one of those projects, but I've seen some of them in action. Now, of course, that would be very, very difficult to see in the context that I have worked in, like Equatorial Guinea or here in Mexico, unfortunately. Catholicism in Equatorial Guinea is adamantly opposed to evangelicals, and there would be no way that any of them would want to work together in any capacity in Bible translation at all. Even though some attempts have been made, here in Mexico, probably Latin America in general, it's usually the case that Catholics are vitriolically opposed to translation into native languages. So this is just a personal anecdote from my dad, who has worked in translation for the Chitino language of another village here in southern Mexico. He's had extreme opposition from the Catholic Church for these efforts, to the point where there have been friars who have told the people who have received these translated scriptures that if they don't burn them, they'll go to hell. All that to say that many people who are evangelicals in contexts like this one would say, we are never going to translate baptism in a way that might sound Catholic, right? Because the Catholics and the Presbyterians would have a similar form of baptism. They would be more prone to agree on a term for that. That implies something like sprinkling or washing. Now, in Equatorial Guinea, it's an interesting situation that I got to work with. There was a team working on the Kombe language, which is a minority language there. And it was formed by a Presbyterian woman who's older, who really loved the Bible. And the Presbyterians had a long legacy in Equatorial Guinea. So Presbyterian missionaries from United States, from Pennsylvania specifically, had come there around 1850 and had a significant impact very early on. They had done some Bible translation. And so we were revising a pretty old translation that they had done into Kombe. But they had done it just from the KJV, and there were other problems, and it was now extremely outdated, need to be modernized with the current use of Kombe, etc. But the problem is that the Presbyterian Church had compromised in a lot of ways. They had become very syncretistic, involving themselves with a lot of witchcraft, and also they were largely known to be alcoholics. Well, when Pentecostals arrived on the scene, they quickly took over the entire landscape of Christianity there and became the vast majority, even though they weren't recognized as by the government as an official church. But if you asked any Pentecostal, who they called themselves evangelicals, they didn't think that anyone else was evangelicals except Pentecostals there. If you asked them, is a Presbyterian a Christian, they would say absolutely not. And so even the people who worked on this translation team, who were from a Pentecostal background, even though they respected this woman for her love of the Bible and her willingness to participate in this translation project, which she basically spearheaded, they did not consider her to be a Christian. So they just were, I guess, compromising in their hearts. They were saying, okay, we're going to work with this unbeliever for this common cause because we love our language and we love the Bible, etc. So hopefully that'll give you just a little taste of the kinds of things you're up against when you enter into different contexts across the globe and the tensions that can be involved in Bible translation. Thankfully, in my case, they didn't have long drawn-out discussions about the term they were going to use for baptism because it had long been established back in the 1800s, and they didn't feel like it needed to be rehashed. Now, unfortunately, that translation or revision project quickly ended, number one, because Mama Lili, the woman, the Presbyterian woman, who was like a grandmother to me in a lot of ways, she passed away. I still remember her funeral. She was very famous in the community, well-known, well-loved. She was also a nurse and had a clinic, and there were tons of people who came out to her burial. And then after all of that, the main couple that was sustaining the progress of that project, they eventually joined a cult, the William Brunham cult, which is not well known in the U.S., but it did come from an American guy named William Brunham, who was part of the early Pentecostal movement and then later created his own anti-Trinitarian cult. And unfortunately, there are about 2 million people around the world or more who are still deceived by his teachings, which somehow are being translated into a lot of languages. This was pretty heartbreaking, as you can imagine, and I had lots of long, drawn-out conversations with the guy and his wife about this issue. I actually even went and visited the church of William Brunham with this guy to try to understand where he was coming from a little bit more. It's real interesting. This church is, you know, they divide the men and women from each other. They sit on opposite sides of the sanctuary, and then up in the sanctuary in front behind the pulpit is a big picture of William Branham. Pretty ugly, balding white guy, which is pretty sad leader to follow, who's dead, died in 1965. But no matter how long and patiently I and others talked to them about this, they stayed with it to this day. And it just so happened that he was one of my better friends there in Equatorial Guinea, one of the people I felt closest to, like we really got along super well. And we had gone through a lot together, spent a lot of time, and he was a really bright guy, really passionate. He was a go-getter with a lot of attention to detail, and it just broke my heart to see him get seduced by this cult. And you know, without getting into it too much, part of it was because he had been burned by some really corrupt, hyper-charismatics in the area. There's a lot of really messed up stuff coming out of the neighboring country of Gabon. So they're sending out a lot of unconverted prosperity sort of preachers who yell really loudly and don't walk righteously in any way. And he had gotten really entrenched in the passion, newfound passion of following the Lord, really entrenched in one of these churches. And with a pastor who ended up doing some really horrible stuff. So on the rebound from that, he went straight into this cult because he wanted a church that was really Bible saturated. And this one actually has an incredibly intense emphasis on the Bible, which honestly a lot of cults do, right? And so in his thirst for some people who really took the Bible very, very seriously, he went into this one because, just to be honest, in Equatorial Guinea, it's almost impossible to find a church that is balanced, Bible-saturated, Christ-exalting, and God-centered. Anyway, a little rabbit trail there, but I hope this helps people get a better understanding of some of the issues, some of the challenges that come up in the world of Bible translation, not only in China, but in other parts of the world. Working for the Word is a podcast where we believe the Bible is a unified, God-breathed, God-centered, hope-giving book, sweeter than honey and pointing to Jesus. This podcast exists to help us treasure the Bible more, go deeper into it, and become like the man of Psalm 1.